But there on the beach sat one as gaunt as a heron, Anne Claiborne. Saxe hesitated, but she had already seen him, and so he walked on until he stood by her side. She glanced up at him and then stared out again at the white lake. "You really look different," she said. "Yes." He could still feel the sore spots in his face and mouth, though the bruises had cleared up. It felt a bit like wearing a mask, and suddenly that made him uncomfortable. "Same me," he added. "Of course." She didn't look up at him. "So you're off to the overworld?" "Yes. To get back to your work?" "Yes." She looked up at him. "What do you think science is for?" Saxe shrugged. It was their old argument, again and always, no matter what kind of beginning it had. To terraform or not to terraform, that is the question. He had answered the question long ago, and so had she, and he wished they could just agree to disagree and get on with it. But Anne was indefatigable. "To figure things out," he said. "But terraforming is not figuring things out." "Terraforming isn't science. I never said it was. It's what people do with science, applied science or technology, what have you. The choice of what to do with what you learn from science, whatever you call that. So it's a matter of values."
"I suppose so."
Saxe thought about it, trying to marshal his thoughts concerning this murky topic. "I suppose our disagreement is another facet of what people call the fact-value problem. Science concerns itself with facts and with theories that turn facts into examples. Values are another kind of system, a human construct."
"Science is also a human construct."
"Yes, but the connection between the two systems isn't clear. Beginning from the same facts, we can arrive at different values."
"But science itself is full of values," Anne insisted. "We talk about theories with power and elegance. We talk about clean results or a beautiful experiment. And the desire for knowledge is itself a kind of value, saying that knowledge is better than ignorance or mystery, right?"
"I suppose," Saxe said, thinking it over.
"Your science is a set of values," Anne said. "The goal of your kind of science is the establishment of laws, of regularities, of exactness and certainty. You want things explained. You want to answer the whys all the way back to the Big Bang. You're a reductionist. Parsimony and elegance and economy are values for you, and if you can make things simpler, that's a real achievement, right?"
"But that's the scientific method itself," Saxe objected. "It's not just me, it's how nature itself works, physics. You do it yourself.
There are human values embedded in physics."
"I'm not so sure." He held out a hand to stop her for a second. "I'm not saying there are no values in science. But matter and energy do what they do. If you want to talk about values, better just to talk about them. They arise out of facts somehow, sure, but that's a different issue. Some kind of sociobiology or bioethics. Perhaps it would be better just to talk about values directly. The greatest good for the greatest number, something like that."
"There are ecologists who would say that's a scientific description of a healthy ecosystem, another way of saying climax ecosystem."
"That's a value judgment, I think. Some kind of bioethics. Interesting, but..." Saxe squinted at her curiously, decided to change tack. "Why not try for a climax ecosystem here, Anne? You can't speak of ecosystems without living things. What was here on Mars before us wasn't an ecology. It was geology only. You could even say there was a start at an ecology here, long ago, that somehow went wrong and froze out, and now we're starting it up again." She growled at that, and he stopped.
He knew she believed in some kind of intrinsic worth for the mineral reality of Mars. It was a version of what people called the land ethic, but without the land's biota. The rock ethic, one might say. Ecology without life. An intrinsic worth, indeed. He sighed. Perhaps that's just a value speaking. Favoring living systems over non-living systems. I suppose we can't escape values, like you say. It's strange. I mostly feel like I just want to figure things out, why they work the way they do. But if you ask me why I want that, or what I would want to have happen, what I work toward... He shrugged, struggling to understand himself. It's hard to express. Something like a net gain in information. A net gain in order. For Sachs, this was a good functional description of life itself, of its holding action against entropy. He held out a hand to Anne, hoping to get her to understand that, to agree at least to the paradigm of their debate, to a definition of science's ultimate goal. They were both scientists, after all. It was their shared enterprise. But she only said, "So you destroy the face of an entire planet. A planet with a clear record nearly 4 billion years old. It's not science. It's making a theme park. It's using science for a particular value, one I believe in. As do the transnationals, I guess. It certainly helps them. It helps everything alive, unless it kills them. The terrain is destabilized. There are landslides every day." "True, and they kill. Plants, people. It's happened already." Sachs waggled a hand, and Anne jerked her head up to glare at him. "What's this, the necessary murder? What kind of value is that?" "No, no, they're accidents, Anne. People need to stay on bedrock, out of the slide zones, that kind of thing, for a while. But vast regions will turn to mud or be drowned entirely. We're talking about half the planet. The water will drain downhill, create watersheds. Drowned land, you mean, and a completely different planet. Oh, that's a value, all right. And the people who hold the value of Mars as it is... We will fight you every step of the way." He sighed. "I wish you wouldn't. At this point, a biosphere would help us more than the transnationals. The transnats can operate from the tent cities and mine the surface robotically while we hide and concentrate most of our efforts on concealment and survival. If we could live everywhere on the surface, it would be a lot easier for all kinds of resistance." "All but red resistance." "Yes, but what's the point of that now?" "Mars, just Mars, the place you've never known." Sachs looked up at the white dome over them, feeling distress like a sudden attack of arthritis. It was useless to argue with her. But something in him made him keep trying. "Look, Anne, I'm an advocate of what people call the minimum viable model. It's a model that calls for a breathable atmosphere only up to about the 2 or 3 kilometer contour. Above that, the air would be kept too thin for humans, and there wouldn't be much life of any kind. Some high-altitude plants, and above that, nothing, or nothing visible. The vertical relief on Mars is so extreme that there can be vast regions that will remain above the bulk of the atmosphere. It's a plan that makes sense to me. It expresses a comprehensible set of values." She did not reply. It was distressing, it really was. Once in an attempt to understand Anne, to be able to talk to her, he had done research in the philosophy of science. He had read a fair amount of material, concentrating particularly on the land ethic and the fact-value interface. Alas, it had never proved to be of much help. In conversation with her, he had never seemed able to apply what he had learned in any useful manner. Now, looking down at her, feeling the ache in his joints, he recalled something that Kuhn had written about Priestley. that a scientist who continued to resist after his whole profession had been converted to a new paradigm might be perfectly logical and reasonable, but had ipso facto ceased to be a scientist. It seemed that something like this had happened to Anne, but what then was she now? A counter-revolutionary? A prophet? She certainly looked like a prophet, harsh, gaunt, angry, unforgiving. She would never change, and she would never forgive him. And all that he would have liked to say to her about Mars, about Gamete, about Peter, about Simon's death, which seemed to haunt Ursula more than her, all that was impossible. This was why he had more than once resolved to give up talking to Anne. It was so frustrating never to get anywhere, to be faced with the dislike of someone he had known for over 60 years. He won every argument, but never got anywhere. Some people were like that, but that didn't make it any less distressing. In fact, it was quite remarkable how much physiological discomfort could be generated by a merely emotional response. Anne left with Desmond the next day. Soon after that, Sax got a ride north with Peter in one of the small stealth planes that Peter used to fly all over Mars. Peter's route to Burrows led them over the Hellespontus Montes, and Sax gazed down into the big basin of Hellas curiously. They caught a glimpse of the edge of the ice field that had covered Low Point, a white mass on the dark night surface, but Low Point itself stayed over the horizon. That was too bad, as Sax was curious to see what had happened over the Low Point Mohole. It had been 13 kilometers deep when the flood had filled it, and that deep it was likely that the water had remained liquid at the bottom and probably warm enough to rise quite a distance. It was possible that the ice field was in that region an ice-covered sea with telltale differences at the surface. But Peter would not change his route to get a better view. "You can look into it when you're Stephen Lindholm," he said with a grin. "You can make it part of your work for Biotique." And so they flew on. And the next night they landed in the broken hill south of Isidis, still on the high side of the great escarpment. Sax then walked to a tunnel entrance and went down into the tunnel and followed it into the back of a closet in the service basement of Libya Station, which was a little train station complex at the intersection of the Burrows Hellas Piste and the newly rerouted Burrows Elysium Piste. When the next train to Burrows came in, Sax emerged from a service door and joined the crowd getting on the train. He rode into Burrows main station, where he was met by a man from Biotique. And then he was Stephen Lindholm, newcomer to Burrows and to Mars. The man from Biotique, a personnel secretary, complimented him on his skillful walking and took him to a studio apartment high in Hunt Mesa near the center of the old town. The labs and offices of Biotique were also in Hunt, just under the Mesa's plateau, with window walls looking down on the canal park. A high-rent district, as only befitted the company leading the terraforming project's bioengineering efforts. Out the Biotique office's windows, he could see most of the old city, looking about the same as he remembered it, except that the mesa walls were even more extensively lined by glass windows, colorful horizontal bands of copper or gold or metallic green or blue, as if the mesas were stratified by some truly wonderful mineral layers. Also, the tents that had topped the mesas were gone, their buildings now standing free under the much larger tent that now covered all 9 mesas and everything in between and around them. Tenting technology had reached the point where they could enclose vast mesocosms, and Sax had heard that one of the transnats was going to cover Hebe's Chasma, a project that Anne had once suggested as an alternative to terraforming, a suggestion that Sax himself had scoffed at. And now they were doing it. One should never underestimate the potential of material science. That was clear. Burrows' old canal park and the broad glass boulevards that climbed away from the park and between the mesas were now strips of green cutting through orange tile rooftops. The old double row of salt columns still stood beside the blue canal. There had been a lot of building, to be sure, but the configuration of the city was still the same. It was only on the outskirts that one could see clearly how much things had changed and how much larger the city really was. The city wall lay well beyond the nine mesas, so that quite a bit of surrounding land was sheltered and much of it built upon already. The personnel secretary gave Sax a quick tour of Beatique, making introductions to more people than he could remember. Then Sax was asked to report to his lab the next morning and given the rest of the day to get settled in. As Stephen Lindholm, he planned to exhibit signs of intellectual energy, sociability, curiosity, and high spirits, and so he very plausibly spent that afternoon exploring boroughs, wandering from neighborhood to neighborhood. He strolled up and down the wide swards of street grass, considering as he did the mysterious phenomenon of the growth of cities. It was a cultural process with no very good physical or biological analogy. He could see no obvious reason why this low end of Isidus Planitia should have become home to the largest city on Mars. None of the original reasons for sighting the city here were at all adequate to explain it. So far as he knew, it had begun as an ordinary way station on the pieced route from Elysium to Tharsis. Perhaps it was precisely because of its lack of strategic location that it had prospered, for it had been the only major city not damaged or destroyed in 2061, and thus perhaps it simply had had a head start on growth in the post-war years. By analogy to the punctuated equilibrium model of evolution, one might say that this particular species had accidentally survived an impact that had devastated most other species, giving it an open ecosphere to expand in. And no doubt the bowl-like shape of the region, with its archipelago of small mesas, gave it an impressive look as well. When he walked around on the wide grassy boulevards, the nine mesas appeared evenly distributed, and each mesa had a slightly different look, its rugged rock walls distinguished by characteristic knobs, buttresses, smooth walls, overhangs, cracks, and now the horizontal bands of colorful mirror windows and the buildings and parks on the flat plateaus crowning each mesa. From any point on the streets one could always see several of the mesas, scattered like magnificent neighborhood cathedrals, and this no doubt gave a certain pleasure to the eye. And then if one took an elevator up to one of the mesas' plateau tops, all about 100 meters higher than the city floor, then one had a view over the rooftops of several different districts and a different perspective on the other mesas, and then, beyond those, the land surrounding the city for many kilometers, distances larger than were usual on Mars because they were at the bottom of a bowl-shaped depression. Over the flat plain of Isidus to the north, up the dark rise to Syrtis in the west, and to the south, one could see the distant rise of the great escarpment itself, standing on the horizon like a Himalaya. Of course, whether a handsome prospect mattered to city formation was an open question, but there were historians who asserted that many ancient Greek cities were cited principally for their view in the face of other inconveniences, so it was at least a possible factor. And in any case, Burrows was now a bustling little metropolis of some 150,000 people, the biggest city on Mars, and it was still growing. Near the end of his afternoon sightseeing, Sax rode one of the big exterior elevators up the side of Branch Mesa, centrally located north of Canal Park, and from its plateau, he could see that the northern outskirts of town were studded with construction sites all the way to the tent wall. There was even work going on around some of the distant mesas outside the tent. Clearly, critical mass had been reached in some kind of group psychology, some herding instinct which had made this place the capital, the social magnet, the heart of the action. Group dynamics were complex at best, even, he grimaced, unexplainable. Which was unfortunate as always, because Beatique Burrows was a very dynamic group indeed, and in the days that followed, Sax found that determining his place in the crowd of scientists working on the project was no easy thing. He had lost the skill of finding his way in a new group, assuming he had ever had it. The formula governing the number of possible relationships in a group was n times n minus 1 over 2, where n is the number of individuals in the group, so that for the 1,000 people at Biotique Burrows, there were 499,500 possible relationships. This seemed to Sachs well beyond anyone's ability to comprehend. Even the 4,950 possible relationships in a group of 100, the hypothesized design limit of human group size, seemed unwieldy. Certainly it had been at Underhill when they had had a chance to test it. So it was important to find a smaller group at Biotique, and Sachs set about doing so. It certainly made sense to concentrate at first on his lab. He had joined them as a biophysicist, which was risky, but put him where he wanted to be in the company, and he hoped he could hold his own. If not, then he could claim to have come to biophysics from physics, which was true. His boss was a Japanese woman named Claire, middle-aged in appearance, a very congenial woman who was good at running their lab. On his arrival, she put him to work with the team designing second and third generation plants for the glaciated regions of the Northern Hemisphere. These newly hydrated environments represented tremendous new possibilities for botanical design, as the designers no longer had to base all species on desert xerophytes. Sachs had seen this coming from the very first moment he had spotted the flood roaring down Ayas Chasma into Melis in 2061, and now 40 years later he could actually do something about it. So he very happily joined in the work. First, he had to bring himself up to date on what had already been put out there in the glacial regions. He read voraciously in his usual manner, and viewed videotapes, and learned that with the atmosphere still so thin and cold, all the new ice released on the surface was subliming until its exposed surfaces were fretted to a minute lacework. This meant there were billions of pockets, large and small, for life to grow in, directly on the ice. And so one of the first forms to have been widely distributed were varieties of snow and ice algae. These algae had been augmented with phreatophytic traits, because even when the ice started pure, it became salt-encrusted by way of the ubiquitous wind-blown fines. The genetically engineered, salt-tolerant algaes had done very well, growing in the pitted surfaces of the glaciers and sometimes right into the ice. And because they were darker than the ice, pink or red or black or green, the ice under them had a tendency to melt, especially during summer days when temperatures were well above freezing. So small diurnal streams had begun to run off the glaciers and along their edges. These wet moraine-like regions were similar to some Terran polar and mountain environments. Bacteria and larger plants from these Terran environments, genetically altered to help them survive the pervasive saltiness, had first been seeded by teams from Biotique several M-years before, and for the most part these plants were prospering as the algae had. Now the design teams were trying to build on these early successes and introduce a wider array of larger plants and some insects bred to tolerate the high CO2 levels in the air. Biotique had an extensive inventory of template plants to take chromosome sequences from, and 17 M-years of field experimental records, so Sachs had a lot of catching up to do. In his first weeks at the lab and in the company arboretum on Hunt Plateau, he focused on the new plant species to the exclusion of everything else, content to work his way up to the bigger picture in due time. Meanwhile, when he was not at his desk reading or looking through the microscopes or into the various Mars jars in the labs or up in the arboretum, there was the daily work of being Stephen Lindholm to keep him busy as well. In the lab, it was not all that different from being Sachs Russell, but at the end of the work days, he would often make a conscious effort and join the group that went upstairs to one of the plateau cafes to have a drink and talk about the day's work, and then everything else. Even there, he found it surprisingly easy to be Lindholm, who, he discovered, asked a lot of questions and laughed frequently, whose mouth somehow made laughter easier. Questions from the others, usually from Claire and an English immigrant named Jessica and a Kenyan man named Burkina, very rarely had anything to do with Lindholm's Terran past. When they did, Sachs found it was easy to give a minimal response. Desmond had given Lindholm a past in Sachs's own hometown of Boulder, Colorado, a sensible move, and then he could turn things around on the questioner in a technique he had often observed Michelle using. People were so happy to talk, and Sachs himself had never been a particularly quiet one like Simon. He had always pitched in his conversational ante, and if he had contributed infrequently thereafter, it was because he was only interested when the stakes reached a certain minimum level. Small talk was usually a waste of time, but it did, in fact, pass the time, which otherwise might be irritatingly blank. It also seemed to ameliorate feelings of solitude, and his new colleagues usually engaged in pretty interesting shop talk anyway. And so he did his part and told them about his walks around Burroughs and asked them many questions about what he had seen and about their past and biotique and the Martian situation and so on. It made as much sense for Lindholm as for Sachs. In these conversations, his colleagues, especially Claire and Burkina, confirmed what was obvious in his walks, that Burroughs was in some sense becoming the de facto capital of Mars, in that the headquarters for all of the biggest transnationals were located there. The transnationals were at this point the effective rulers of Mars. They had enabled the Group of 11 and the other wealthy industrial nations to win, or at least survive, the War of 2061, and now they were all intertwined in a single power structure, so that it wasn't clear who on Earth was calling the shots. The countries or the supra-corporations. On Mars, however, it was obvious. Unoma had been shattered in 2061 like one of the domed cities, and the agency that had taken its place, the United Nations Transitional Authority, was an administrative group staffed by Transnat executives, its decrees enforced by Transnat security forces. "The UN has nothing to do with it, really," Burkina said. "The UN is just as dead on Earth as Unoma is here. So the name is just a cover." Claire said,
"Everyone calls it just the Transitional Authority anyway."
"They can see who is who," Burkina said. And indeed, uniformed transnational security police were to be seen frequently in Burroughs. They wore rust-colored construction jumpers with armbands of different colors. Nothing very ominous, but there they were. "But why?" Sachs asked. "Who are they afraid of?"
"They're worried about Bogdanovists coming out of the hills," Claire said, and laughed. "It's ridiculous."
Sachs raised his eyebrows, let it pass.
He was curious, but it was a dangerous topic. Better just to listen when it came up on its own.
Still, after that, when he walked around Burroughs, he watched the crowds more, checking the security police wandering around for their armband identification. Consolidated, Amex, Orico. He found it curious that they hadn't formed a single force. Possibly the transnationals were still rivals as well as partners, and competing security systems would naturally result. This perhaps would also explain the proliferation of identification systems which created the gaps that made it possible for Desmond to insert his personas into one system and have them creep elsewhere. Switzerland was obviously willing to cover for some people coming into its system from nowhere, as Sachs's own experience showed, and no doubt other countries and transnationals were doing the same kind of thing. So in the current political situation, information technology was creating not totalization, but balkanization. Arkady had predicted such a development, but Sachs had considered it too irrational to be a likely eventuality. Now he had to admit that it had come to pass. The computer nets couldn't keep track of things because they were in competition with each other, and so there were police in the streets keeping an eye out for people like Sachs. But he was Stephen Lindholm. He had Lindholm's rooms in the Hunt Mesa. He had Lindholm's work, and his routines, and his habits, and his past.
His little studio apartment looked very unlike what Sax himself would have lived in. The clothes were in the closet. There were no experiments in the refrigerator or on the bed. There were even prints on the walls, Escher's and Hundertwasser's, and some unsigned sketches by Spencer, an indiscretion that was certainly undetectable. He was secure in his new identity. And really, even if he was found out, he doubted the results would be all that dramatic. He might even be able to return to something like his previous power. He had always been apolitical, interested only in terraforming, and he had disappeared during the madness of 61 because it looked as if it might be fatal not to do so. No doubt several of the current transnationals would see it that way and try to hire him. But all that was hypothetical. In reality, he could settle into the life of Lindholm. As he did, he discovered that he enjoyed his new work very much. In the old days, as head of the entire terraforming project, it had been impossible not to get bogged down in administration or diffused across the whole range of topics, trying to do enough of everything to be able to make informed policy decisions. Naturally, this had led to a lack of depth in any one discipline, with a resulting loss of understanding. Now, however, his whole attention was focused on creating new plants to add to the simple ecosystem that had been propagated in the glacial regions. For several weeks he worked on a new lichen designed to extend the borders of the new bioregions, based on a chasmoendolith from the Wright Valleys in Antarctica. The base lichen had lived in the cracks in the Antarctic rock, and here Sax wanted it to do the same. But he was trying to replace the algal part of the lichen with a faster algae, so that the resulting new symbiote would grow more quickly than its template organism, which was notoriously slow. At the same time, he was trying to introduce into the lichen's fungus some phreatophytic genes from salt-tolerant plants like tamarisk and pickleweed. These could live in salt levels 3 times as salty as seawater, and the mechanisms, which had to do with the permeability of cell walls, were somewhat transferable. If he managed it, then the result would be a very hardy and fast-growing new salt lichen. Very encouraging to see the progress that had been made in this area since their first crude attempts to make an organism that would survive on the surface back in Underhill. Of course, the surface had been more difficult then, but their knowledge of genetics and their range of methods were also greatly advanced. One problem that was proving very obdurate was adjusting the plants to the paucity of nitrogen on Mars. Most large concentrations of nitrites were being mined upon discovery and released as nitrogen into the atmosphere, a process Sax had initiated in the 2040s and thoroughly approved of, as the atmosphere was desperately in need of nitrogen. But so was the soil, and with so much of it being put into the air, the plant life was coming up short. This was a problem that no Terran plant had ever faced, at least not to this degree, so there were no obvious adaptive traits to clip into the genes of their aeroflora. The nitrogen problem was a recurrent topic of conversation in their after-work sessions at the Café Loewen up on the Mesa Plateau's edge. "Nitrogen is so valuable that it's the medium of exchange among the members of the underground," Burkina told Sax, who nodded uncomfortably at this misinformation. Their cafe group made its own homage to the importance of nitrogen by inhaling N2O from little canisters passed from person to person around the table. It was claimed, with marginal accuracy but very high spirits, that their exhalation of this gas would help the terraforming effort. When the canister came around to Sax for the first time, he regarded it dubiously. He had noticed that one could purchase the canisters in restrooms. There was an entire pharmacology inside every men's room now, wall units that dispensed canisters of nitrous oxide, Omegendorf, Pandorf, and other drug-laced gases. Apparently, respiration was the current method of choice for drug ingestion. It was not something that interested him, but now he took the canister from Jessica, who was leaning against his shoulder. This was an area in which Stevens and Sax's behaviors diverged, apparently. So he breathed out and then put the little face mask over his mouth and nose, feeling Stephen's slim face under the plastic. He breathed in a cold rush of gas, held it briefly, exhaled, and felt all the weight go out of him. That was the subjective impression. It was fairly humorous to see how responsive mood was to chemical manipulation, despite what it implied about the precarious balance of one's emotional equanimity, even sanity itself. Not on the face of it a pleasant realization, but at the moment not a problem. In fact, it made him grin. He looked over the rail at the rooftops of boroughs and noticed for the first time that the new neighborhoods to the west and north were shifting to blue tile roofs and white walls, so that they were taking on a Greek look, while the old parts of town were more Spanish. Jessica was definitely making an effort to keep their upper arms in contact. It was possible her balance was impaired by mirth. "But it's time to get beyond the Alpine Zone," Claire was saying. "I'm sick of lichen, and I'm sick of mosses and grasses. Our equatorial fell fields are becoming meadows. We've even got Krumholtz, and they're all getting lots of sunlight year-round, and the atmospheric pressure at the foot of the escarpment is as high as in the Himalayas." "Top of the Himalayas," Sachs pointed out, then checked himself mentally. That had been a Sachs-like qualification. He could feel it. "As Lindholm," he said, "but there are high Himalayan forests." "Exactly. Stephen, you've done wonders since you arrived on that lichen. Why don't you and Burkina and Jessica and CJ start working on subalpine plants? See if we can't make some little forests." They toasted the idea with another hit of nitrous oxide, and the idea of the briny frozen borders of the aquifer outbreaks becoming meadows and forests suddenly struck them all as extremely funny. "We need moles," Sachs said, trying to wipe the grin from his face. "Moles and voles are crucial in changing fell fields to meadow. I wonder if we can make some kind of CO2-tolerant Arctic moles." His companions thought this was hilarious, but he was lost in thought for a while and didn't notice. "Listen, Claire, do you think we could go out and have a look at one of the glaciers? Do some of the work on site?" Claire stopped giggling and nodded. "Sure. In fact, that reminds me. We've got a permanent experimental station out at Arena Glacier with a good lab. And we've been contacted by a biotech group from Armscor, one with a lot of clout with the Transitional Authority. They want to be taken out to see the station in the ice. I guess they're planning to build a similar station in Marineris. We can go out with that group and show them around and do some field work and kill two birds with one stone." Plans to make this trip actually made it from the Lowen into the lab and then the front office. Approval came swiftly, as was usual in biotech. So Sachs worked hard for a couple of weeks, preparing for the field work, and at the end of that intensive period he packed his bag and one morning took the subway out to Westgate. There in the Swiss garage, he spotted some people from the office, gathered with several strangers. Introductions were still being made. Sachs approached, and Claire saw him and drew him into the crowd, looking excited. "Here, Stephen, I want to introduce you to our guest for the trip." A woman wearing some kind of prisming fabric turned around, and Claire said, "Stephen, I'd like you to meet Phyllis Boyle. Phyllis, this is Stephen Lindholm." "How do you do?" Phyllis said, extending a hand.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 5 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 6.